are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. This is Right on Radio, the show where we talk to local, national, and international authors about craft, creativity, and the ideas behind their writing. This week, we have two episodes from the archives. And without further ado, let's get to it.
Hello, everyone. This is Josh Weber with Right on Radio, joined in studio for the first part of the hour with Michelle S. Phelps, the author of The Minneapolis Reckoning, Race, Violence, and the Politics of Policing in America. Michelle is professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. She's also the co-author of Breaking the Pendulum, The Long Struggle Over Criminal Justice. Her research has been featured in The Washington Post, The New Yorker, Time Magazine, NPR, 538, and other media outlets, and has informed criminal justice reform efforts by the Human Rights Watch and Pew Charitable Trust Public Safety Performance Project. Michelle, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You note in the preface of your book how the crowd around George Floyd at the time of his death was unlike lynchings of earlier decades. It was witnessed by a multiracial and majority black crowd of residents. How did the diverse composition of the crowd witnessing Floyd's death influence the public's reaction and the subsequent protests?
Yeah. So if we back up a bit, you know, there's this whole debate about how to best describe what was just initially described in the media as officer-involved shootings, right? Are they deaths? Are they killings? Are they murders? And when George Floyd was killed, subsequently deemed a murder, of course, by the court system, at the time, as the video was circulating, people took to calling it a lynching, evoking the long history of state and vigilante violence, often by white people, against black Americans. And so it was evoking this earlier image. But if we go back to the period where lynchings were at their height in the United States, in part as a reaction to the end of slavery and the beginning of the civic rights of black Americans, what we saw was that those lynchings were often these jubilant affairs where there were actually cheering crowds of white people. This was actually a way that white people and the South would come together in community through this manipulation and mutilation of black bodies. And so what was different about Floyd's killing than those lynchings that it was tied to was that it wasn't witnessed by a predominantly white crowd who was cheering. It was witnessed by this multiracial crowd who were yelling out in horror, who were trying to stop the officers. And so, you know, part, I think, of why that murder was so resonant in the public space in a way that a lot of other police killings have not been was because of that crowd of witnesses, that saw immediately that what was going on here was not normal, was not acceptable, and that police were killing a man. And so I think we can track a lot of the aftermath and the way that killing, indeed murder, galvanizes the public as being in part a reaction to that crowd. And it's the crowd that's filming it. It is the crowd that is calling out to police officers to stop. It is the crowd that will ultimately wind up testifying in court against the officers.
What historical factors have contributed to the strained relationship between the Minneapolis Police Department and the black community?
So I start the book, The Minneapolis Reckoning, with a chapter on the history of the city. And I went back and forth about where to start that chapter in time. And I wind up going all the way back to colonization and how we come to have this territory first around Fort Snelling and then in Minneapolis. And I go all the way back to the beginning of the city to say, when we look at police violence, that is the end result of a long causal process, but also a long historical process of racism and injustice. And so we can't understand what happened that day in Minneapolis to George Floyd without understanding the decades that preceded it, and the decades that preceded it produced a really unequal Minneapolis, right? A Minneapolis that is rated as one of the top places to live, and the benefits of that largely accrue to its white residents. And so I wanted to understand not just policing, but the context in which this brutal and racialized policing exists in our society. And you couldn't understand that without going back decades. And one of the through lines that we see in this history, so Minneapolis got its first share of Black migrants relatively late in the Great Migration, which brought Black families up from the South. Because we're so far north, we were relatively a late stop on that process of migration. But from the beginning, you start to see these community outrage at unjust police treatment, at police brutality. We can go back to the 1940s. We can go back to 1950s. We can go back to the 1960s. And so it was important to say that nothing of what we saw in 2020 or in the earlier BLM years in the city, none of that was new, right? All of that had resonance. Both the police violence had resonance with the past, but also community outrage and calls to do something to transform this institution had these very clear echoes with the past.
Can you discuss the significance of the public's role in documenting and disseminating footage of George Floyd's death? How did this impact the narrative and actions taken afterward?
So there's a lot you could say about why the Black Lives Matter movement, or BLM, as it's often referred to, why it exploded in the moment that it does. You know, certainly we can draw continuities with the past, probably most proximally the videotaping of the beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles. There had been these moments of outrage about police violence that had been caught on tape. But certainly the development of smartphones and everybody having this camera recording device in their pockets, and not just these recording devices, but access to social media where anybody could disseminate that footage as well, really, I think, brought into the public conversation something that Black America had long known, but that white America only had to grapple with during these periodic kind of flare-ups of public concern about police violence. And so, you know, I think in Minneapolis and the case of the murder of George Floyd, what was so, I think, profound there is that if you look at the immediate press release that the MPD put out, it bears almost no resemblance to what we saw on video, right? And it was that disjuncture that led this teenage girl, Darnella Frazier, to release that footage, right? And it goes viral precisely because it so contradicted the official account. So if all we had had was the official MPD account, if we hadn't had that community witnessing, and the way that community witnessing was not just a localized phenomenon, but was caught on camera and then went across the world, we would not have seen the scale of protest that we saw. Maybe some of that footage would have eventually come out with body camera footage if, you know, the right folks had been pushing the case to get that released. But it certainly would not have become this overnight horror had it not been for that crowd of witnesses and their ability to immediately document and immediately counter the MPD's version of events, and to immediately spread the word, not just in Minneapolis, not just in Minnesota, not just in the United States, but across the globe.
What were the main strategies and tactics used by Minneapolis activists to bring attention to Black Lives Matter and police reform? How did local and national political climates affect the activism and outcomes in Minneapolis?
Right. So this second chapter of the book traces those early BLM protests in Minneapolis and how they evolve into what I call the movement field by the time we get to 2020 and the murder of George Floyd. And what we know from Minneapolis and a lot of other cities is that the BLM movement took place both online and offline. Right. So online, people were documenting and sharing examples of police injustice, often caught on camera. But there were also offline real world protests, right? And so we saw in Minneapolis, the first BLM protest erupted in 2014 as solidarity protests with Ferguson. And then we saw in 2015, after the police killing of Jamar Clark in North Minneapolis, protests, BLM protests again erupt in the city. And so it was this melding of both online, these newer forms of digital activism, with these more traditional direct actions. including an 18-day occupation outside of the 4th Precinct building, which would become kind of the prototype for what becomes the siege of the 3rd Precinct in 2020. And why I think Minneapolis was unique, you know, it's an interesting city because a lot of the cities that we initially associated with BLM activism were majority Black cities and places. We can think of Ferguson, we can think of Baltimore, places with really sizable Black communities. And in Minneapolis, Black Americans represent less than 20% of the population. It is still a majority white city. And so in some ways, it was an odd place for this new wave of Black freedom dreams to take root. But in other ways, you know, the progressivism, the sort of liberal reputation of the city meant that we've always had a deep bench of activist groups pushing for justice, including around issues of policing and police brutality. And so those folks had kind of seeded the ground so that when we saw this national movement, Minneapolis was one of the places it would take root.
What role did community organizing and grassroots movements play in shaping the public discourse on policing in Minneapolis?
So I think, you know, activists are largely to credit for drawing the public spotlight on Minneapolis, right? In the wake of Jamar Clark's killing, in the wake of Philando Castile's killing. It's important to note that it wasn't the MPD that killed Philando Castile. It was in a nearby suburb, but people associated it with the kind of Twin Cities region. And so it was really those activists that were putting a spotlight that would grow much, much stronger, of course, in summer 2020 on what was happening with policing here and the racism of the North, right? The way in which the Minnesota thinks of itself as this, you know, always free state and this like sort of bastion of racial equality. And yet is this place where we see these profound racial disparities. That is what activists were pointing out. And what I trace in that chapter about how the movement field evolved is that by the time you get to 2018, even 2017, you're seeing a shift away from efforts towards police reform and the beginnings of this movement towards a police-free future, which will seed the ground for calls to defund the police and calls to abolish the police. And the national movement that we saw with the defund hashtag and slogan and real campaign demands and promises, all of that, I think, takes root across the country in part because activists in Minneapolis were ready to seed that demand and they were ready to take center stage as all of the media outlets decamped on the city after the murder of George Floyd and the protests that we saw here. And so it was really, there was a moment there where Minneapolis was really leading the country in terms of reimagining what we might do to solve the problem of racialized police violence.
There's a part of your book where you talk about there are residents that feel left out of the discussions and reforms regarding policing. I was wondering if you could talk about who those people are and why they feel this way. What are the
So when I started this project, which began long before George Floyd was murdered, I actually had intended to stop this project in 2019. I have versions of the papers of this project where I try to explain why people should care about Minneapolis, which are haunting to read after the murder of George Floyd. But in those early days of the project, back in 2017, I was mostly interviewing the activists and organizers and people involved at the MPD and its leadership. And I had a student who was on a summer research fellowship with me. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I really want to know how residents of the most impacted communities, the places that are most exposed to both crime in the community, but also police violence, how are they making sense of this public conversation, right? Everybody's now claiming to listen to Black voices. Everybody's claiming that we're going to center the margins. But what we're centering is activists. And what are those everyday residents? What do they make of all of this political discourse about the realities of their communities and what they're facing? And so we did. And in the end, this was a real team-based project. I had several graduate students that joined the project as well. And we wound up interviewing over 100 residents in North Minneapolis from 2017 to 2019. And what those residents told us, by and large, was that they felt trapped between community violence and police violence. And many of them, not all, but many of them, most of them, the majority, were were supportive of what BLM activists were doing, but there was also this persistent critique of we have to address community violence at the same time. And that was really a lesson to me about how we think about what movements can do and the way that movements spotlight particular segments of problems under a particular framing, and how people living in places that have, you know, high unemployment rates, that have environmental degradation, that have schools where most of the kids aren't graduating, where there's no job market for those kids to speak of, where people are getting shot on the street frequently. All of those crises and all those problems are intertwined, and policing and police violence is just one piece of that, right? And they're experiencing all of the state violence all at once and all tangled up together. And that impulse to say we have to fix racism, like, it isn't just about the police, it isn't just about police violence, it is about how do we solve racism in America, that becomes the through line for the book. And ultimately, as I argue in the back half of the book, which traces what happens after the murder, I think that's one of the lessons of why the charter amendment to end the MPD and replace it with a new Department of Public Safety fails, is it was not because people were supportive of the MPD by and large, it was because people were worried about what would happen if we took it down in this particular way in the face of officer resistance and chief resistance and resistance from the mayor. And it was that wanting of a sort of holistic solution that people were really calling out for. And so, you know, I think and that critique of, you know, the activists, that critique came at us as university researchers. People are like, why are you studying this? Like, who asked you to study this? What are you going to do about it? Why are you talking to us instead of like actually making change? And it extended to the city leaders, too, who they saw as largely ineffectual in solving this big tangle of problems. And so the book tries to kind of grapple with what would it mean to really have these kinds of holistic solutions that those communities that feel left out are really ultimately calling for.
How has George Floyd's death continued to affect the Minneapolis community and the movement for racial justice?
You know, this is such a complicated one. I think on the one hand, you know, we can trace so much mobilization and so much energy in that moment of summer 2020 that felt so radical and so full of potential. We can also very easily trace the backlash that has followed, right? We can think about the backlash against critical race theory that took up the Republican Party for a while. We can think about the upcoming elections and the very real possibility that Donald Trump becomes our next president again. We can read a lot of that through the lens of this backlash to summer 2020. So, you know, on the one hand, we saw all of these statements come out in summer 2020. Suddenly, Republicans were on board with BLM. Suddenly, corporations were demanding that Black Lives Matter. Suddenly, every business, every organization, every community was going to have ways of thinking about more holistic models of safety and inclusion and diversity. And many of those efforts have failed to come to fruition. So, you know, if we think just most narrowly about legislative reforms to policing, the reforms at the city level, which we can get more into later, but those have largely not panned out yet. They're still ongoing. At the state level, they largely fizzled out without any meaningful legislative reform. At the federal level, we couldn't even get the reformist Justice for George Floyd Act passed. And so on the one hand, I think we, especially in Minneapolis, are still living in this moment of post-trauma in a lot of ways, but I also think the national conversation has in some ways moved on and moved on even past the immediate backlash, let alone the sort of initial movement. So I think it's a really, it's a complicated moment. There are people still certainly fighting for justice and fighting for change. There are certainly people still pushing back, and there are a whole new set of questions that have preoccupied public attention.
What mechanisms of accountability have been put in place or proposed to address police misconduct in Minneapolis, and how effective? Well, you, I guess, just said that there has been very little efficacy right now. But so, yeah, what mechanisms of accountability have been put in place to address police misconduct?
Right. So, you know, there are several waves of reform efforts. We see, you know, immediately after the killing of George Floyd, we saw the Minnesota Department of Human Rights jump in and open an investigation. That immediately led to a negotiated agreement with a series of reforms, including banning chokeholds and a duty for officers to intervene. We saw another wave of reforms that was touted by the mayor in the run-up to the November 2021 elections. We saw another wave of reforms that came out after the police killing of Amir Locke in downtown Minneapolis under a no-knock raid. We have seen more come out once the MDHR negotiated their agreement with the Minneapolis Police Department. The MPD is now under a consent decree with the courts, and they are negotiating another one with the Department of Justice, which opened its own investigation and released its own report. But evidence that any of these things have made a big dent is really hard to find. So, for instance, a lot of the things that were promised in that initial MDHR agreement when the investigation started, evidence that was found by investigators at both the state and the federal level in their report suggested that officers weren't abiding by those initial conditions, even when investigators were present, right? And they were evading data collection in other ways. So, for instance, with the scrutiny on racial disparities and stops, officers stopped reporting the race of the person they were stopping, right? The mayor promised that he had ended no-knock raids, and then we saw the killing of Amir Locke. And so there had been sort of a wave of promises. A civilian review is another one where we saw a wave of promises around civilian review that have largely not borne out. If anything, civilian review right now is more of a mess than it was before the murder. But, you know, these processes are really ongoing. You know, right now the city is in the process of still negotiating that second consent decree. There will be a CART monitor tasked with evaluating the department's compliance with both of those consent decrees. And I will say, very cautiously, a little bit optimistic that court-led reform will lead to small incremental improvements moving forward, but it's still very much an open question. I think the only thing where we can say we've got definitive numbers on this where we can show an impact is actually not a policy at all, but it is that the number of MPD officers is now more than a third smaller than it was when George Floyd was murdered. But that wasn't because the department was defunded. It wasn't because it was dismantled. It is because they cannot hold on to officers. And that has caused all kinds of problems for the department. But it has also meant that the kind of routine harassment that communities of color experience, the routine stops from police, those have really gone down. So that was not a deliberate reform initiative, but it is one place we can see in the data where this daily friction between police and communities has gone down. But so has responsiveness to crime in the community and communities' calls for help.
What alternative models of public safety have been proposed or implemented in Minneapolis? I was wondering how successful this has been.
Yeah, so I know we're running tight on time. I could talk for so long on this. This is the last chapter of the book, and I think the most important and exciting thing. But I will say very briefly, I profile three different models in that chapter. One is violence prevention and interruption work, where you send out folks from the community into the community to intervene with typically the men in their late teens and 20s who are most likely to be both the perpetrators and the victims of violence, and you work to intervene in that violence. We've also seen the development of the BCR, the Behavioral Crisis Response Team. So right now in Minneapolis, if you call 911 and you're having a behavioral health crisis that does not involve any threat of violence, the city, if the vans are available, will send out trained mental health and behavioral health professionals to come and respond to your calls. And we also have community-led safety strategies that are trying to divert people away from the 911 system altogether and to show how neighbors can show up for one another. And so I think all three of these models in really different ways show that we don't have to have this death grip of the police on our ideas about public safety. We can respond to crises. We can prevent crises in lots of different ways. And I think the more people with the more different professional identities and expertise coming to the table when we have these moments of, you know, there's a rise in any kind of victimization or public safety concern, I think we need to have more people than just the police at the table. And I think these new models give us at least the beginning of pathways to think about what that more holistic model might look like.
Then my last question for you, because I'm way too curious not to ask you this. How do you envision the path forward for communities like Minneapolis in the pursuit of justice and equity?
You know, my most important takeaway is that we have to keep paying attention. You know, I go to the memorials in George Floyd Square every year, and every year you can feel people's trauma, and not just the trauma from the murder, but the trauma of nothing meaningful happening in the wake of the murder, despite all the community outrage. That can really demobilize people and lead people to think, this is just too hopeless. Why even bother, right? And what I'm trying to say with the book is that, you know, these are entrenched structural problems. I don't want to gaslight anybody that these are simple problems to fix. But all of us can do a part. And one of the things that we can do by playing a part, in addition to thinking about racial justice and building community in our everyday lives, in our work lives, in our professional lives, but also our home lives and our, you know, where we live and our children. But the other thing we can do is just keep our eye on this, right? The system thrives when people tune out and stop paying attention. And it's just so vital that that energy that we had in summer 2020, that that kind of pressure stay on city leaderships and that people participate in the process to really make democratic policing that does right by our country.
This has been our time talk with Michelle S. Phelps about her recently published work from Princeton University Press, The Minneapolis Reckoning, Race and Violence and the Politics of Policing America, available now where books are sold. Michelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And now this.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Zimmerman, and this is your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. On Wednesday, January 29th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Milkweed Books in Minneapolis, Kimiko Han will present her newest collection, The Ghost Forest, New and Selected Poems, with Torin A. Greathouse and Michael Kleber Diggs. On Wednesday, January 29th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Next Chapter Booksellers in St. Paul, Margaret Haas, James P. Lenfestry, and J.P. White will read from their work. On Wednesday, January 29th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at White Squirrel Bar in St. Paul, Minds on Fire Live, featuring readings by L.M. Brimmer, Haley Losh, and Claire Wamenholm, who happens to be my cousin. On Wednesday, January 29th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Rondo Community Library in St. Paul, Pallavi Sharma Dixit will present Edison. On Wednesday, January 29th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis, the annual Perprick Student Poetry and Short Works Reading. On Wednesday, January 29th, 7 to 8 p.m. at the O'Shaughnessy in St. Paul, Rebecca Yaros will present Onyx Storm. Just to let you know, that is sold out. On Thursday, January 30th, 6 to 7 p.m. at Next Chapter Booksellers in St. Paul, Jojo Bell will present Red Stained, The Life of Hilda Sims. On Thursday, January 30th, 6 to 7 p.m. at The Thinking Spot in Wayzata, Ravi Bapna will present Thrive. On Thursday, January 30th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Nokomis Library in Minneapolis, Brian Duran will present The Gravity of Love. On Thursday, January 30th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., there will be a virtual event where Lee Hawkins will present I Am Nobody's Slave, How Uncovering My Family's History Set Me Free, in conversation with Lisa Jones. On Saturday, February 1st, 2 to 3 p.m., at the Red Balloon Bookshop in St. Paul, Freya Manfred and illustrators Bly and Rowan Pope will present Fumius Rex, the Outcast Cat. On Saturday, February 1st, 4 to 6 p.m. at Cream and Amber in Hopkins, Boozy Book Fair featuring a meet and greet with various local authors and interactive games and activities with prizes. On Sunday, February 2nd, 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. at Big Hill Books in Minneapolis, Dr. Ella Gates Mahmood will launch A 5-Second Prayer. And on Monday, February 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Stillwater Public Library, Drelandra Larkins, Freya Manfred, Greg Watson, and Joshua Davies will read from their work. This has been your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. There are many other events you can check out at the Rain Taxi site at raintaxi.com. And now, our second archived episode of the evening.
I imagine the first appointment with a new therapist is never easy. However, it is about 8 million times more difficult when you don't talk. In my defense, this doctor has been forewarned. My parents called ahead of time. They told the others beforehand too, but I'm hoping this therapist will be smart enough to know when he asks me, "And what brings you here today?" My only response will be to slowly lift my eyes to his face and stare at him like I'm trying to suck out his soul. That being said, or, well, unsaid, as soon as the door to his office opens, I shoot to my feet, then start to sit, then change my mind and hover in an awkward squatting position like I'm about to lay an egg in his waiting room. He blinks, his expression unreadable. After a few excruciating seconds of silence, he says, "You must be Machi." I chew my lip. It's good to know I'm as socially incompetent as ever. "It's a pleasure to meet you," he says. "I'm Dr. Tsui. Would you like to come in?" Not really, but I don't have a choice. I follow him into the office, casting one last backward look at the exit like I'm about to be imprisoned for a crime I never meant to commit. I mean, it's not illegal to stop talking, is it? Why can't I plead the fifth for the rest of my life? "Welcome to my office," Dr. Tsui says, closing the door behind me. I can practically hear Angel scoff. "What a dork," she would say. I think Sunny would like him. He seems nice, compassionate. You need someone who understands you without making you explain everything that brought you here. But I can easily explain what brought me here. They did.
You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM, St. Paul. I am Eric Zimmerman, and I am speaking to author Kelly Murashige about her debut novel, The Lost Souls of Benzaiten, a beautiful story which combines the modern world with Japanese mythology to explore happiness, friendship, and the potential for healing. Kelly Murashige, welcome to Right On Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited and nervous.
This is your debut novel. Can you describe the process of getting it published?
Sure. So it was actually kind of a long process. Publishing kind of always is, but I think I started this book back in November of 2020, and at that point I'd had a literary agent already, and I really wanted to write about a girl who becomes a robot, or, well, wants to become a robot vacuum cleaner, and prays to a Japanese goddess, which is, you know, already kind of a strange setup. But back then, the protagonist could talk, and the whole journey was very different. And then I kind of just set that aside. And then in 2021, sometime later, I basically started all over again. I was like, what if she can't talk? And then we eventually, I showed it to my agent and I was like, "I know this is weird, but I kind of like it. Do you think we could go out with this?" And so she also thought it was weird, but in a good way. And so we went out with it. I got some really great feedback from a lot of people and ended up revising it into something closer to what it is now. And then after that, in late 2022, we went out with it. The next month, we got an offer from Soho, which was so, I don't know, it was very surreal. And then we got another offer from a different publisher. So then that was kind of like, oh, now we need to talk things over about what the exact meaning of the deal is and what are we going to be doing with it. And then in December 2022, we accepted the offer with Soho. And then for the next 8 months, it was pretty quiet. So it kind of, I think because I couldn't talk about it with a lot of people, it started kind of feeling like, oh, maybe it was a dream. Maybe it isn't really real. And so then when we finally could announce it, then it was, you know, this big thing. And I started editing it with my editor, who's so great. And it was just this huge rush. And then it kind of went quiet again. And then in the beginning of this year, we started sending out the arcs. And then it started feeling real. And I could actually hold it in my hands. And it's been a long but really amazing journey, I think.
That sounds like a lot of ups and downs on that journey of
definitely.
So you said you already had the idea for a girl who prays to a Japanese goddess about wanting to become a robot vacuum cleaner. What made you want to write that story in particular?
I really think it was just something that I had thought before. You know, I've never had a robot vacuum cleaner, unfortunately. Our house is too cluttered. It would run into everything. But I always thought they were very cute. And so, you know, I thought, oh, it's really nice that we kind of name them and, you know, just really like them and we have such strong feelings about them. So I kind of had this idea of what if a girl wants to become one because of something that's maybe happened in her real life. And then because I had been researching Japanese mythology, Japanese folktales, I thought, oh, well, maybe she prays to a goddess. And so, yeah, it sounds weird, but that is how it came together.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So your main character, Machi, wishes to become a robot vacuum cleaner. And this is because of circumstances in her past that I would say cause her to be depressed.
Right.
Yeah. The depiction of Machi's depression is honestly the most accurate depiction that I've ever read, given my own history with depression. Is there any research or experience that you drew on for this depiction?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate you saying that. But I think I always say, you know, this isn't totally my story. I've never prayed to become a robot vacuum cleaner, but a lot of it does come from personal experience. And I think I really found I appreciate mental health representation in books. I especially appreciated it when I was around Machi's age. So I think that was kind of, it felt like I was being seen and I kind of wanted to do that for other people. And I knew that it wouldn't be the same for everybody. You know, some people might be like, well, it's not like that for me at all. But a lot of people might see themselves and kind of feel seen in reading it. And that was what I was hoping to do.
How do you write a character in that depressed mindset without falling into that kind of depression yourself?
I think in a way it was kind of cathartic to write about it. You know, I always express myself a lot better through writing than I did in talking. I think I've processed a lot of things, even things from my childhood, things from later on, that in different books. So you know how people always say, oh, you kind of put a piece of yourself into each book. I think that was something that I needed to do with this. So, but at the same time, I think I balanced it out with kind of Anxiety, because she's a bit of a character. She's very quirky, very bold. And I think it's not like I put her in just because, oh, I wanted a funny character. But I think a lot of the time I'm drawn to that kind of levity, I guess. And there are touches of humor, and Machi kind of has this wry sense of humor herself. And so that was kind of how I think I tried to avoid, you know, just having it all be very sad and making myself sad and making readers sad forever. And I also wanted to make sure that there is a lot of hope in the book, you know, and that's one thing that I always want to have in writing.
You talked about how writing this out helped you. The structure of Machi's writing as clearly separate from the narration of the text is a fascinating element of the story. What made you want to include her writing rather than having her narrate some of these ideas and histories from her point of view?
I definitely think people may not understand the choice, especially because the book is in first person. It's already very close to her. So I can see why some people might think it's a little redundant almost. But I think there's something very vulnerable about writing, especially because she's usually writing to somebody. And sometimes when you're specifically speaking to somebody, even if it's in a letter, you kind of reflect on different things. Whereas in narration, you can very much push things away if you don't really want to think about them. And I also think, like I said, I process a lot through writing. And actually, one thing I realized when I started writing was it helped people understand me in a very different way. Like even my mom, I'm very notoriously very close to my mom. And then, but she is very different. She's total extrovert. She has a billion friends, you know, and so a lot of times she didn't understand where I was coming from. So then this one time I remember writing a story about how I was unable to tell my desk partner happy birthday for like 10 whole minutes. And so because it was just so hard for me for some reason. And so until she read that, she didn't really understand how hard it was and why it was hard. So I feel like I wanted to have Machi write because maybe she doesn't speak, she doesn't really express herself all the time in narration, but there are things that she will tell the people she's addressing her letters to.
So in Machi's story, Machi reflects a lot and her family is dealing with the death of her grandparents. She talks about a lot of racism and alienation from that community that happens in that town that the grandparents live in. But there's not as much like very clear, direct racism towards Machi in the book. How does your depiction of that racism in her grandparents' town interact with Machi's own alienation from her own community?
Yeah, so I think obviously racism is an important thing to talk about, but I also didn't want to delve into it as she's necessarily experiencing it, because I was lucky enough to grow up in a place where there are a lot of Asian Americans. And so it kind of felt like it wasn't necessarily my story to tell, but at the same time, a lot of people I know have experienced it. And so I think there are lots of ways to feel like an outsider. It's not always about the way you look. Sometimes it's the way you act or just the way you express yourself. And so I wanted to kind of explore those different things while also explaining why, you know, there is a big element of culture in this story. You know, it's a Japanese goddess, and I kind of wanted to write about that, but then also how are people trying to escape their societies? How are they trying to escape themselves? Can they even? So that's kind of a rambly answer, but I guess I wanted to kind of explore it. And you're right, there is a lot of alienation in the book, not just about racism, but about your own identity and all those different aspects. So I hope that I handled it in a way that feels genuine to at least some people. That's always the goal.
Speaking of alienation, the characters of Sunny and Angel haunt the story long before we meet them or even before we discover what they did. Machi seems to agree with their conclusions and actions, even while being deeply hurt by them. Do you think this agreement is a symptom of her own depression and lack of self-worth, or is there something else that makes her accept their judgment of her?
I think it might be a little bit of both. I think even if it's not somebody very close to you, a lot of quiet people have heard that, oh, don't you ever talk, or like, oh, you're so quiet. And I think that can sort of start to, I mean, I don't think it's always a mean thing. Sometimes it's just an observation. But when you start to hear that, maybe you think, oh, I am kind of quiet. And then maybe you see a lot of other people doing crazy things and you're like, oh, I don't do that. So I think that it kind of, it might have started with her, but hearing it from the people you called your best friends is definitely different, because it's kind of like, it makes me think of people saying, you know, oh, well, if you wouldn't take advice from somebody, why would you, you know, listen to what they have to say, you know, something like that. I'm not explaining it well, but it's kind of like, but what if you are, you do trust that person and you do believe in what they say and they know you better than anybody, then of course I think you're going to take it a lot more seriously. So I do think it's a combination of things, and that's probably why it seemed so devastating to her.
This story explores a certain type of relationship between the thrill-seeking extroverted type and the kind of homebody introverted type, which Machi symbolizes as yin and yang. What drew you to depicting and examining this type of relationship through so many different lenses? Angel and Sunny, Machi and Ben Zaitin, Angel and Machi, among others.
I think part of it was personal experience, because a lot of my close friends are very different. And like I said, my mom's very different from me. And I kind of wanted to explore that, but then also say, you know, how does it work? How do opposites attract? But then what happens if that doesn't really work out? You know, what if they clash too much? And I think a lot of the parallels started emerging almost by themselves. I often say, you know, sometimes things just take on a life of their own. And that was one time when it felt like, oh, you can see it in this relationship, but then also this relationship. And it feels like everything starts coming back to everything. And, you know, that's part of the whole balancing act. We're trying to balance so many things at once. And I really wanted to explore, you know, these different personalities, but then also when, what makes it work and what, when does it stop working?
Yeah, now would be a great time to hear another passage from your story.
Sure. I always tell myself I don't need much. It's been that way ever since I was little. When I first started school, my mother armed me with a pencil, a wide-ruled composition notebook, and a beaten-up canvas bag she had gotten for free with the purchase of a dozen eggs. I was self-conscious enough already, but upon reaching my classroom, I saw everyone else in my class had backpacks. Whenever we lined up all our bags on the side of the carpet, mine stuck out, drooping to one side, one strap snaking out like a pale, limp arm, stretching towards something out of reach. I didn't say anything to my mother. I told myself I didn't need a backpack. My old bag was perfectly usable. That's what I told all the people who asked why my bag was so ugly. It works just fine. Then one day, somehow, my mother found out I was the only one without a backpack. On the way home, she said, "Why didn't you tell me? I could have gotten you a backpack." "I didn't need one," I said, but I was crying in relief. I changed in some ways as I grew up, but that one thing, the conviction that I don't need much, has always remained. I don't need my voice. I don't need friends. I don't need a goddess, especially one who won't even grant my original wish. I can make it on my own. But then I let myself go for a moment, and when I come crashing back to Earth, I'm there, needing.
Thank you so much. You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAN 90.3 FM, St. Paul. We are talking to Kelly Murashige about her debut novel, The Lost Souls of Ben Zaitin. This story combines a really grounded and realistic depiction of mental health in our modern world with a lot of fantastical and mythological elements. What drew you to combine these two seemingly conflicting elements of storytelling?
I think it was kind of, we were just talking about the yin and yang thing, and I think this is kind of another example of it. When I was really young, I would write very fantastical stories about stuffed animals talking and, you know, the tooth fairy and everything. And then when I got older, I started writing purely contemporary and, you know, I was like, oh, I don't need to write about fantastical. I was a little bit snobby, I think. And I was like, oh, I'm very realistic. And then somewhere along the way, I think I started reconnecting with my culture and learning more about different folk tales and goddesses, and I was like, oh, I really like this. And so I think I tried to lighten stories a little bit without losing sight of realism. And it's not that I think fantasy can't be serious, because it very much can be, or that realism can't be fun because, you know, rom-coms and everything. But I think it was kind of, that was how I really started to find what I wanted to do, you know, just a little bit of quirkiness, but also things that are very real and maybe help people in different ways. And also, you know, I grew up on games like Room Factory and books like Percy Jackson. And, you know, I was always very into those things that tackle very real subjects in ways that maybe you wouldn't expect. So I really wanted to do that. And it wasn't until I started doing that that I really felt like I was doing what I wanted to do.
There's also something that I was thinking about earlier today. There is a kind of different kind of fantasy when it comes to Ben Zeitin, which is not the fantasy of gods and magic, but the fantasy of that someone who is depressed might have, that someone who is extroverted and absolutely in love with life will make it their mission to help you. How did you want to play with that fantasy in this story, and how does it kind of get complicated by your narrative?
I think that kind of touches on a lot of kind of real life things. You know, people always say, oh, I'm an introvert, I want an extrovert to adopt me. Or, you know, kind of like the awkward guy who meets a manic pixie dream girl or something like that. And I do think I kind of play with that, but the whole point was, and this was something that I talked to my editor a lot about, was, you know, things shouldn't be magically solved. You know, it's not like Ben Zeitin's going to fix everything. A lot of it has to do with Machi fixing herself and learning how to fix herself. And that was something that I really wanted to emphasize, that, you know, maybe there's not going to be magic in the way that you expect it to. Like, you're maybe not going to take a happy pill and then everything's going to be okay, but you can find magic in the little things, you know, so you can start talking to that neighbor you kind of think is funny, or you can join a group just out of the blue, and then maybe that'll help you start to connect with people. So I think there is a danger in kind of saying that, you know, oh, everything's better because of this one person. And that's also something that's explored even without magic, you know, that Machi was so dependent on her friendships. When it was broken, she was kind of like, oh, well, then there's nothing really left for me, I guess. So yeah, that is something that is very important, and I'm glad that you brought it up.
And then on the other, you talked a little bit about Japanese mythology and folklore. There are two gods in this story, Ben Zeitin and Daikokuten, and who are interesting and full characters in their own right. What about these mythological figures made you feel that they would be a good fit for your story?
I think I was very drawn to Ben Zeitin, and it was always these two, even in the very early versions. But Ben Zeitin was probably because she's the only confirmed female goddess in the seven lucky gods, or the seven gods of fortune. And so I really wanted to explore that female dynamic, I think. But then also I read these certain stories about her, like how she's the goddess of love, and if she doesn't think that you're with the right person, maybe she'll like break you up, you know, and those kinds of things. And so I thought, oh, I think it would be interesting to kind of explore her character, because there are some legends, but then a lot of them either conflict or they don't really go into detail. And I kind of thought, well, what if I could kind of fill in the blanks or try to? And then with Daikokuten, I think it was almost kind of the opposite in a way. There wasn't a whole lot about him, whereas a lot of the other seven lucky gods, they're very well known, or they have stories about them. Like Ebisu is one of the most famous ones, I think. And people name their businesses after him or their restaurants because he's known to bless you if you name it after him. So I kind of wanted to go with one that didn't have a whole lot of background information. So I think, and also I liked the idea that he had this rice mallet. I don't know why. So that was one thing that I really wanted to include.
I think we have time for about one more question. The moments where Machi lives through the ghosts are some of the most heart-wrenching in the story. Would you say that these moments of extreme empathy change Machi's understanding of herself and her situation?
I would say definitely there's a lot of guilt around it, you know, of the whole, oh, well, why am I sad when other people have it so much worse? And that's a very common sentiment, I think, and also one that can be very damaging, because we are all going through things and they're all very valid things, I think. And I think that's part of why I'm so drawn to writing and reading, is you're experiencing other people's stories, even if whether they're fictional or not. It's you're learning empathy and you're kind of expanding your horizons. And I think it's not so much like, oh, my life isn't so bad after all. It's more like there are so many different life experiences and people get through things in so many different ways. And we all have our own stories to tell, and who's to say that yours won't be important to somebody, because it always is.
Thank you. You are listening to Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM, St. Paul. I'm Eric Zimmerman, and I'm speaking to author Kelly Murashige about her debut novel, The Lost Souls of Ben Zeitan. Kelly, where can people find your book?
I believe it's distributed by Soho Teen through Penguin Random House. Am I allowed to plug my own website?
Because
there are links.
Yes.
So it's Kelly Murashige, which is, you know, very hard to spell, .com. I have all sorts of things on there. I'm constantly updating my website, but there should be links there.
All right. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. I had an amazing time. Thank you.
You have been listening to Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Zimmerman. We would like to thank our former guests, KFAI listeners and supporters, and our Write On Radio listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. If you missed any shows or want to listen to this one again, you can check out all your favorite Write On Radio podcast episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere you stream your podcasts. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.